Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Ercan. Today, I'm joined by Christian Anderson, Associate Professor in the School of Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences at the University of Washington at Bothell. We'll be talking about his book, Urbanism Without Guarantees, The Everyday Life of a Gentrifying West Side Neighborhood, published in 2020 by the University of Minnesota Press. So thank you very much, Christian, for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I'm super excited about this chance to connect and share my work.
We're also very excited to hear about your work. But before we delve into the book, we have a little bit of convention at the New Books Network where we like to get to know our authors a little bit better. So, especially since you're based in an interdisciplinary department, I'm curious about your background across multiple disciplines and how it led you to conceive of this book.
Yeah, that sounds like a great place to start. I've heard it said that a lot of people's academic books are actually autobiographical, maybe just in ways that aren't totally obvious. So I think that's true enough, and that's a good place to start. So I don't know how much detail you want, but in terms of biography, I guess I could start with where I'm from. So I was born and raised in an inner ring suburb of Minneapolis in Minnesota, in a place that once I got a little older and had some chances to travel to places outside of that spot, I started to understand was a pretty particular, and I guess I would say specifically Midwestern American sort of second half of the 20th century kind of space and time. I don't know if you've spent a lot of time in U.S. suburbs, but they have their own peculiar cultures that are really embedded in the specific places. So some of my first critical questions were kind of about what was going on in a space like that, sort of about why do we have these kinds of cultures and spaces and modes of life here instead of different kinds of cultures and modes of life? How is it that ordinary life in places like this can come to seem and feel sort of really natural and inevitable and almost taken for granted, even though if you sort of stop to think about it, so many of the things there are fabricated, or I started to think about them as like things are made up. Who gets to make these things up? How does that work? And how is that connected to sort of bigger sweeps of history and human development and experience? What kinds of different futures might be possible given all that? So those were like, I don't know, maybe they were angsty teenage questions at one point, and then I just kind of held on to them over the years and kept trying to find people who were smart and could speak to those kinds of things. And I guess that's how you end up being an academic and an ethnographer on that meandering path. So I did my undergraduate work at the University of Minnesota, and I actually made up my own degree through this. Yeah, It was cool. They have this program called, I think it was called Interdisciplinary Interdepartmental Major. And you had to find like three faculty members who would sign off on basically a program and a list of courses. And there was a capstone project. And I put together a combination of urban studies, cultural studies, history, a little sociology. And I was lucky enough to have some faculty members who were able to kind of support me in thinking about place-based research and ethnography and some of the questions I was into and channel my angst in more productive directions. And then I worked a number of years as a childcare provider after my undergraduate degree, which was super interesting for kind of getting into the everyday life of the city in Minneapolis and the place where I lived. Then I did a master's degree and I took a chance and moved to London and went to this program at Goldsmiths at the University of London that was called the Masters in Culture, Globalization and the City. And I guess it was technically sociology, but there was a bunch of anthropologists there. Paul Gilroy had just recently been on the faculty, so there was a big infusion of British cultural studies and kind of thinking through questions of globalization and hybridity and cultural politics in really interesting ways. And there were a couple people that I learned a lot from there. My advisor was this guy called Michael Keith, who did really fantastic work around sort of urban cultural geographies and policy. And then there was an ethnographer named Les Back, who really modeled a lot of kind of humility and ways to do ethnography that I still think about a lot. And at that point, I thought I was a sociologist. And they told me, you know, for U.S. sociology, you might be more of a geographer or an anthropologist. So I started to look at different programs and they pointed me to the CUNY Graduate Center in New York, where there was a group of people who were doing really interesting things who also had toes in other disciplines. So my dissertation advisor was Cindy Katz, who does a lot of work in feminist geography, but also American studies and environmental psychology. Mariana Pavlovskaya was a great mentor, and she sort of straddles geography and diverse economies, a bunch of other folks there. Vinay Gidwani was there for a while, this anthropologist named Jeff Maskowski, and then David Harvey and Neil Smith and Ruthie Gilmore and all these sort of amazing thinkers. So in the end, I had a lot of the same questions that I had always had, but now sort of shaped by those sensibilities. And that's kind of how I got into the book. Was thinking about some of those same questions, now looking for a kind of place-based ethnographic way to get at some of those things. And that's how I ended up in the space where I ended up and sort of thinking about these questions in the setting that I write about in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it really helps to hear more about sort of your journey through places as well. Journey through places as well and not just disciplines. It seems like a sensibility that really guides your work. It seems like you ended up in New York and your book is about a New York neighborhood called Hell's Kitchen. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping you could orient us to Hell's Kitchen, especially for our listeners who might not be familiar with this specific neighborhood. What led you to Hell's Kitchen, and what about this neighborhood in particular illuminated your thinking on these longstanding questions?
Yeah, great question. And in the book, the space of the neighborhood is almost like a kind of character or like an interlocutor in itself. So this is a great question and a good way to get into the book. So just to situate, if we're thinking about Manhattan, the sort of Hell's Kitchen, or some people call it Clinton too, the name is contested. I talk about that a little bit in the book. If you're thinking about Manhattan, it's on the far west side of the middle of Manhattan, sort of so north of 42nd Street, south of Columbus Circle and the Lincoln Center area, a couple blocks to the west of Times Square and the Broadway Theater District, and then bordered by the Hudson River and New Jersey to the west. So sort of right smack in the middle of Manhattan, but, you know, interesting for being right smack in the middle of things. So in terms of what led me there, before I started doctoral work, when I first moved to New York from London in 2005, I had a job in a building that was right next to the Port Authority bus terminal on 42nd Street.
Okay.
And it was, I was an AmeriCorps Vista, which is like kind of like a domestic Peace Corps. And I got paid like $15,000, and I got a free Metro card or something like that. So it was like
paid amenities.
Yeah. But, you know, it was like there was a lot of flexibility and time built into the job. So I spent a lot of time on breaks, like wandering around the neighborhood, and the job was in this skyscraper. Mm-hmm. I think we're on like the 36th floor or something like that. So I spent a lot of time like staring out the window down into this space in the new city that I had just moved to, kind of imagining all the intriguing stuff that was going on that I couldn't see. And then going down and walking around the streets and you know, kind of getting to know the neighborhood. And it struck me as a fascinating place, partly because of its proximity to all those really iconic spaces that are so close to it and that are world famous. But then if you walk through parts of the neighborhood, it's actually feels pretty surprisingly off the beaten path in some places. And, you know, the rhythms of everyday life there were really fascinating to me. So when I got into the program at CUNY the next year and I started to think about doing a place-based ethnographic project, I revisited it and dug into some of the history of the space and found it even more intriguing for all that history, which I also talk about quite a bit in the book. But there's this sort of way in which the neighborhood's kind of like, I don't know what the right metaphor is, but it's sort of like a crossroads. Maybe it's a depot. I've heard people refer to it as a backstage. I also kind of think about it as a bellwether for a lot of kinds of questions and issues in U.S. urbanization at different times. So, you know, when it industrializes in the mid-1800s, it's really connected to the Erie Canal and the railroad. And there's a lot of issues around sort of unregulated industrialization and tenement housing for immigrant populations and workers. And you have dock workers there who are on the piers up and down the Hudson. So there's this sort of rough and tumble reputation that develops there, which later on becomes a topic of interest for social workers and people who are like some of the people who are influential in the New Deal. Cut their teeth in the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood, sort of thinking about the intractable social problems of U.S. cities and how you would deal with them. A little later, you have the kind of tensions that show up in like West Side Story around incoming immigration and thinking about different interethnic tension. And then a little later, you have in sort of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it's really an epicenter of the urban crisis and things like broken windows policing, law and order policing. Business improvement districts are sort of piloted there in ways that end up having a ripple effect to all these bigger spaces. So all that to say, there's a lot of intrigue going on there and a lot that I felt like I could dig into. So, you know, when it came time to think about a project, I dug in and it did not disappoint.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And yeah, as we discussed a little bit before this conversation, I currently live in this neighborhood and I recently moved. And yeah, it was wonderful to learn more through your book, because it's also, you know, I feel like Midtown is a space that many people characterize as a place without characteristics. That's not, you know, like as you mentioned, like when you know, don't look from above and sort of go onto the ground, you see that it is actually a space with a lot of character and really emblematic of a lot of broader trends like you brought up.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It doesn't get the cred of the, you know, the other places in New York, but there's a lot going on there. And it's
Definitely. And it's not, I feel like it's not also like the number one place that people want to talk about when it comes to debates on gentrification. So I'm really glad that's where you chose to focus on. And yeah, let's go into a little bit into the book and how you organized it.
Great.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about your background and how you wanted to dip your toes into all these different modes of thinking. And what really struck me about the book was how, you know, the ethnographic chapters follow chapters that make parallax arguments, as you call them. So, you know, there's quite a bit of theoretical heft that's then followed by the ethnography. And I was wondering if you could speak to why you organized the books that way and what kinds of sort of analytical work do you hope that parallax arguments do in the book?
Yeah, I really appreciate this question because I spent a lot of time sort of struggling with how I should organize the book and the chapters and the stories and the theory compared to the ethnography. And I've never felt quite sure that I made a good choice. So if nothing else, it's good to at least explain the logic a little more. So I appreciate the question. In a lot of ways, I feel like, the way that I frame the book is as a kind of, I guess I would say like an unsettling or an attempt to think about some sort of contemporary urban questions, in particular questions about the intersections sort of between value, unwaged and social reproductive labor, gentrification, policing, formations of power from a different perspective than they might be typically approached in a lot of urban theory and especially urban geography, urban political economy. So that's really what that parallax framing is all about. And what that term is sort of doing in the book is trying to think through some of those intersections and questions in a way that takes sort of well-established concepts, theories, thinkers. So for example, I spent time talking about Neil Smith's work on rent gaps and revanchism, debates about the urban question, sort of going back to the 60s, uptakes of Lefebvre on sort of space in everyday life and ultimately a lot of questions around place-based formations of value and sort of big questions in political economy. So sort of taking those debates and concepts and injecting them with elements of different thinkers who have not typically been in those debates or considerations that have not been super front and center in those debates to try and open up those concepts in different and hopefully generative ways. So that's sort of what the parallax arguments do. But I should say, I did not set out to try and write a theoretical book. Originally, when I imagined the book, I was like, oh, it's going to be an ethnography. There's this, you know, really interesting space and all these fascinating people that I spent a lot of time with. I have all this ethnographic data. And I thought I was going to be able to just sort of tell that story. But then a lot of the theoretical stuff sort of emerged from the ethnography and sort of the sense that the shapes of their lives and the things that were going on and a lot of the questions I was interested in were a lot messier than the theoretical frameworks that I felt like I had to work with. So I ended up feeling like I had to do all this theoretical work to be able to actually sort of understand and address what I was seeing in the ethnography. So like, I would say the ethnography drove the theory rather than setting out to write a theoretical book. I had a lot of apprehension around the theory and a lot more fun with the ethnography, mm-hmm. I have to say.
Yeah, so. But it's, yeah, one can really see that like all these theoretical or parallax arguments have emerged from the ethnography. And I found, you to be courageous in a way to really foreground that. And I found that really helpful.
That's very kind. Of course.
and, you know, one of the most compelling concepts that you bring forward actually gives the book its name, Urbanism Without Guarantees. And it's really a concept that does this work of messiness that you just mentioned. So I was hoping you could tell us what this concept entails and what is at stake in undoing the guarantees we take for granted in urbanism.
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, and it's a title concept, right? So I hope I can do a pretty good job at explaining it. So, you know, I guess I would say, again, getting back to some of the things I've already started to hint at, as I was doing the work, there was this real tension between what I was seeing in the everyday lives of the people that I was spending time with and the sort of predominant ways that urban theory has to explain, particularly formations around things like, gentrification, the way that value works in urban space, questions around sort of power and policing. So for example, you know, like one of the people that I spent a lot of time with was this character named Wadi, who's sort of like a central figure in the book and probably the person I spent the most time with. And he was like a really deeply contradictory person in ways that, sort of threw me for a loop in terms of how you make sense of this, theoretically. He lived in a limited equity co-op that he helped to found in the 1970s. And he was on the board of like tenant organizing organizations and had a reputation in the neighborhood as being this kind of public character and figure who sort of was a steward and a caretaker for the neighborhood. And he sort of viewed himself as progressive, supported all kinds of progressive causes. But at the same time, he was very pro-surveillance, very pro-policing. He did a lot of things that seemed like they would potentially directly contribute to kinds of like quality of life policing in the neighborhood. I have this concept in the book that I talk about that I think of as spatial labor. So like the way that people's everyday kinds of activities and undertakings sort of change the space and do things in a way that aggregates up to some of these bigger formations and can feed into them. So he would do things like, pick up litter and remove graffiti and monitor the kinds of flyers that were up in different places and sort of keep eyes on the street, Jane Jacobs style. So he was this really contradictory character. And so one of the questions was, how do we explain contradictory characters like Wadi? And he wasn't the only one. There were a ton of people who were engaged in these kind of activities and doing these kind of things. So that concept of kind of without guarantees is sort of a way of thinking about, how do we think about aspects of everyday life and experience and common sense and different forms of value and things that are more nuanced that sometimes get a little bit crushed in the dominant, largely sort of political economy, exchange value and class-based ways of understanding urban space, the production of urban space, things like gentrification. So that's where we get the sort of without guarantees and what that's trying to get at. And it has a few different meanings. So it's first and foremost a riff on sort of Stuart Hall's arguments about a Marxism without guarantees, where he sort of argues, particularly in relation to formations of right-wing populism, that you can't assume certain kinds of outcomes or political affiliations just based on class. You have to think about common sense. You have to think about ideology, culture, everyday life, and all these strange and bizarre mutations and combinations that can emerge, despite hoping that the right class cred will guarantee good politics. Definitely not necessarily the case. So that's one sense. Without guarantees, kind of that Stuart Hall sense. But a second sense is like, the way that urban life often feels to a lot of people who are living in it. And I don't know I think we all maybe relate to this during COVID, but like, I don't know about you, but me in my day-to-day life, it often feels like a blur. And like things are like up for grabs and uncertain, and I'm not always clear on why I'm making the decisions I'm making or doing the things I'm doing or what it's all going to add up to. And so there's this way that I think everyday life often feels that way to people who are living it. And that sense of living without guarantees can influence the way people feel about things like policing or different changes that are happening in their neighborhood. Or, you know, when we were talking earlier, you talked about like the process of getting into your building and the way that people are really concerned about certain things and not others. I feel like a lot of that gets back to this sense of like the feeling of living without guarantees. So that's sort of another meaning. And then finally, you know, and this is kind of a nerdy thing, but I end the book thinking about kind of how this notion of without guarantees is a statement about how we might differently understand sort of circulations of value and durable social forms that people's energies and activities sort of add up to. And it's a reminder that we can't really assume that people's, you know, sort of activities or what I call spatial labor is necessarily going to result in any one durable form for better or for worse, which really should be like an incitement or a reason for us to think about organizing, to think about the possibilities that are always open, whether it's to try and realize the kind of world we want to live in or to you know, push back on things that seem to be coming into view that maybe we didn't see coming, but that point towards really catastrophic futures, which are not hard to imagine. At this point, and even more so than when I finished writing the book, I would say.
Yeah, this is really insightful. And, you know, I particularly liked your, you know, provocation about contradictory characters or characters that seem contradictory to us. And I feel like that's such a, you know, important methodological intervention in a way that, you know, that kind of focus can really open up these amorphous possibilities. So I really appreciated that. And you mentioned, you know, how a neighborhood feels. And my next question is about everyday practice and performance. Mm-hmm. So another very useful concept, in my view, is performative infrastructure. Through which you show us that value is constantly made and remade by people living their everyday lives in Hell's Kitchen. So what does performative infrastructure allow us to see about value and gentrification?
Yeah, another great question. Your listeners are probably getting the impression that I pack a lot of concepts into the book, and that's kind of true. I have like... But people were like, what is this book about? And I'd be like, well, there are like four or five concepts that I try to develop and pack into the book. And performative infrastructure is kind of like, I don't know, I would say it's like the hinge concept that brings a lot of the sort of theoretical aspects of the book together. So I appreciate the question. So, you know, I've started to hint at some of this in my previous answers, but I mentioned this sort of category of labor that I sort of think about as spatial labor. And that sort of draws directly on a lot of insights from diverse economies literature. So just for your listeners' information, the book was published in the Diverse Economies and Livable World series at Minnesota, which is edited by sort of J.K. Gibson Graham and people from the Community Economies Collective. So there's a healthy dose of that kind of the kind of sensibility that they bring about trying to see things from different perspectives than just capitalist dominance and try and understand where the wiggle room is from there. So that kind of thinking really informs the idea of performative infrastructure. And they think about a lot of like, you know, thinking about theorizing as a kind of performativity and sort of community economies activities as a kind of performativity towards different kinds of worlds. So that's one huge influence. And then another would be sort of feminist and post-colonial economy and a lot of the insights that come from those spaces. So essentially the argument around spatial labor is that there's this category of labor that's largely unwaged and mostly voluntary that people are undertaking in places where they live in order to sort of change or improve the qualities of that place, and that those sort of factor into use values in ways that can aggregate into bigger political economic formations in different ways. And so that sort of dovetails into the performative infrastructure argument, because that's starting to think about the sort of, I don't know if you want to call it the motivations or sort of like the ideological, the cultural, the sort of common sense aspects of that underwrite why people are doing what they're doing. And so there I'm drawing on a lot of work from urbanists, from I would call it majority world urbanisms, but in one of your papers that I read, you call it most of the world urbanisms. Who think quite a bit about how people's labor may or may not get enrolled into things like processes of development or capitalist value making. So, as I know you do in some of your work too, I draw really closely on people like Abdulmalik Simone. I'm also drawing on the work of Lauren Berlant in relation to infrastructure. And those are people who are trying to think through questions about adaptation and habituated practice and affect in relation to infrastructure in really interesting ways. Also drawing on sort of Stuart Hall again and Sylvia Winter. But, you know, the argument here is really that there's like these particular kinds of abstractions or ideas, sort of narrative stories, traditions, forms of common sense that become embedded in place and habituated and sort of carried forward in practice and in everyday life and sort of crystallized into the muscle memory of the way people live their lives in different spaces. And people channel that towards different kinds of outcomes. So, you know, in the book, one example that I spend a lot of time talking about too is the local block association and how concerned they are with things like quality of life, safety and security, improvement, sort of this idea of doing all this work for sort of the public good and public safety. And so the argument is, you know, there's a kind of way of thinking about those things as performative infrastructures that are modes of thought that are embedded and sort of inseparable from everyday routine that carry forward these corpuses of activity and labor that then factor into these values in ways that may or may not get sucked into formations of dominance, or that could be a wellspring for sort of different ways of thinking about different kinds of futures. So, like I said, it's sort of the hinge between all these different kinds of concepts. And I spend a lot of time trying to unpack some of that stuff in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think it's very helpful to think about this as a hinge. And I really appreciate how you draw attention to these sort of common sensibilities or contested notions of, you know, what is for the public goods and what kinds of futures they can create. And my next question is about this. So I want to invite you to think with us about the precarity embedded in these, you know, commonalities or shared sensibilities. And, you know, I'm often in my work really interested in how, you know, what is shared can be not so rosy and how it can get complicated and what we lose when we take that for granted. So I'm wondering, what does a focus on shared or common urban sensibilities conceal and reveal for you in your book?
Yeah. Yeah. So common sense, I've probably said it a dozen times already in this interview. So it's a huge part of what's going on with all this. And again, a lot of that comes from, you know, sort of Stuart Hall and British Cultural Studies, who are drawing heavily on Gramsci. So that's sort of the background. But I don't know, I sort of think about common sense as, you know, one of the things I often try to talk about with students is that Marx riff, that like people make history, but not under conditions of their own choosing. And part of those conditions are common sensibilities and traditions that are maybe inherited from, and here you can hear my like angsty teenager coming out of here, like, what is with this set of common sensibilities that I have inherited in the place where I was born? Inherited from the past in ways that are socially produced, but that can seem really durable. So there's this, I appreciate the thinking about precarity there. So there's a kind of durability, but there's also a way that things always could be made differently. Again, for better, but possibly for worse. That's sort of front and center in how I'm trying to think about a lot of the stuff that was going on in this neighborhood. So again, I had a lot of questions about how common sense plays a role in these broader formations. And I have yet another term that sort of comes in at the end of the ethnography, where I talk about precarious hegemony, which is this sort of double sense of precarity. So there's like when we were talking about the without guarantees and how everyday life often feels, particularly in, you know, busy cities, there's this sense of like the precarity felt and experienced by people living in uncertain times and in, spaces where there might be a lot of perceived crisis, if not just the sort of instability in the scrum of everyday life. And, you know, in this neighborhood, there was this long legacy of, having lived through the kind of urban crises of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and a lot of the people in the Block Association and the sort of old timers, as people refer to them in the neighborhood, still carried with them this sense that they needed to like ward off the crisis from coming back. And if they weren't vigilant, like it would bubble up out of the sidewalk and all of a sudden, you know, like the crack epidemic would re-explode and graffiti would be everywhere. And, you know, like you would go back to the conditions that were in the neighborhood in the 70s. So there was this real sense of like the precarity of everyday life as potentially being vulnerable to regression or erosion, which was, you know, very legitimate given the history of the neighborhood. People were worried that it could be abandoned by capital or the forces of progress or whatever. So they wanted to like hold those things dear. So that's sort of one sense of the precarity. But then there's another sense where like, you know, people like Wadi and a lot of folks, when you talk to them, they were not ideologically wedded to things like racialized policing and gentrification. If you put it to them, they would maybe say, I do not support those things. I am maybe even against those things, but I find my actions sort of contributing to those things in ways that I am maybe uncomfortable with, but that I'm not quite sure what to do about. So another sense of the precarity is like, you know, that a lot of the dominant formations that we have are actually contingent on, I don't know, maybe consent is too strong of a word, but like the continued action of people who are not necessarily even wedded to or for those things. So there is a way that you could think about precarity in terms of, you know, wiggle room or potential for organizing in that space if people are seeking out other possibilities for their lives, but have trouble imagining it or realizing those things in the kind of blur of everyday life, which I mean, maybe again, this is biographical, but I totally feel that way a lot of times. Like my everyday life makes it really hard for me to live up to my best imagination of myself, because I often just feel like I don't have the time or bandwidth to like see my commitments through as well as I would like to. And so there's a sense of like the precarity of it all in that I'm trying to unpack and think about as a space for organizing and wiggle room. And I'll just add, you know, like the conclusion is that, you know, it might sound too simple, but one of the most powerful ways of thinking about social change and sort of the pursuit of a more just future might be to think about mitigating precarity in all its forms to the greatest extent possible and figuring out collective and cooperative ways to do that.
Yeah.
That's, as a strategy.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. And I want to circle back to how you came to these important contributions and very helpful concepts. And, you know, like throughout our conversation, you have given us hints about your ethnographic work or your specific interactions with community members. But I was wondering if you could tell us about the process of fieldwork in general. So what are some methods that proved to be helpful or challenging as you conducted fieldwork?
Yeah, methods. I like it. It's where the rubber really hits the road, right? You can have all these ideas, but you know, you gotta have the methods to make it happen. So I will say, when I started this project, the one thing I was really committed to was the kind of place-based ethnographic methodology, because I was fairly convinced that a lot of different urban spaces would be so layered and rich that if I just spent enough time there, I could come away with more than I could ever wrap my head around and learn a ton. So there, you know, there were moments when I was originally proposing this where advisors and peers were like, I'm not sure what you're committed to other than place-based ethnography. And I was like, yeah, this is my method. This is the thing I'm starting with. So the methods are super important. I will say, you know, with that method in mind, I've already spoken a little bit about how I picked this space, having had some familiarity with it. But, you know, it partly was appealing for this project because there was a lot of this history and, you know, looming questions of kind of development and the future of the neighborhood. So I went there and I tried out a bunch of different methods. I sort of started with a ton of observation. My students think it sounds creepy, but I was like, you know, you just go to public spaces and you sit in the park for several hours. You make notes about what you see. So I spent a lot of time, you know, sitting on stoops, hanging out in the park. I did this thing where I tried to observe different times and seasons throughout the course of a year at every time of day to try and get a sense for like the schedule of the neighborhood. So like, when do the delivery trucks come to the restaurants? When are people coming back and forth from work? What's happening at 2 a.m? You know, like the whole thing. So I worked up a bunch of notes on that. And then I also spent a lot of time trying to go to different public events. So particularly events organized by the Block Association or sort of public festivals or things like that. And then eventually I started to get to recognize some people, and I ended up attending like 3 years worth of Block Association meetings, to the degree where they started to just make fun of me as their perpetual graduate student. And they were never totally, you know, they were always like, yeah, he's doing a project on everyday life in the city and we'll see how it turns out. He's been here for a long time, so I think maybe he doesn't know what he's doing, but it's all part of the method. And then overlapping that, I kind of figured out different strategic people to do interviews with. So I did a ton of supplementary interviews, and I actually volunteered for several months at a nonprofit, at an after-school program. And then through the course of all that, I managed to find 7 people who would let me follow them and sort of embed over the course of their everyday lives. And that ended up becoming the big piece, because we did a lot of different things. So like all the things people do over the course of their everyday lives, you know, going back and forth to work. I joined people at work. We went to the grocery store. We went to the doctor. We walked the dog. We hung out in the park. We sat and watched soap operas in the apartment. I mean, I ended up with transcripts that had like hours of soap opera dialogue that I was like trying to figure out how to work into the book. And I did all that stuff with a tape recorder sort of strapped around my neck so that I had an audio record of all the stuff, no matter how mundane. So I ended up with, you know, a ton of field notes and hours of recording and just sort of a lot of stuff, material to sift through. And all that material ended up being really good for getting at these questions around common sensibilities and sort of the connection or disconnect between what people say and what people do and sort of thought and action and all this. I think ethnography is particularly suited for getting at that stuff. In my classes, I often like get really enthusiastic about ethnography and I'm a big cheerleader for it because I feel like it can get at stuff that other methods have a tough time with.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I'm sure our listeners who are maybe, you know, trying to operationalize their projects will benefit a lot from hearing this. And I really love hearing about your place-based approach, but it also sounds like a temporal approach. I love hearing about how you, you know, follow the course of, you know, different, you know, days, times, and so on.
Yeah, there was a real, like, there was a moment where I was like, this is rhythm analysis. Mm-hmm. This is all, you know, all about the temporalities of everyday life. So yeah, that's right on.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you mentioned how you followed some of the residents throughout their everyday lives. And I want to ask you a little bit more about that. So, you know, even in the book, you know, there are a lot of, you know, visual material, photographs, your very like intimate descriptions of moving through the days with some of these people in their domestic spaces and public spaces. So this made me curious about the role of intimacy in your methodology. How was the process of building and maintaining these intimacies?
Yeah, I love the way that you have phrased this. So I feel like intimacy is a really good way to put it. And it's frankly not something that I thought a great deal about when I started the work. I think I was just really excited to sort of get at everyday life and understand all this stuff. And then obviously as time went on, the intimacy part became, you know, pretty front and center in a lot of this thinking. So, I mean, first I have to say, I think that the city and really the sort of time and place that this happened, did me a lot of favors in terms of being able to develop and maintain the kind of relationships that I had. So I do not think I could get that level of access now. Partly because of the way that sort of politics and levels of trust have shifted, let alone the COVID protocols. I mean, the thought of like sitting in people's apartments and watching soap operas now is, you know, it's a different game. So I think a lot of things have changed pretty drastically since then. So part of it is like, you know, a product of that space and time. But at that point, I would say, you know, the thickness of life in New York and the sort of thickness of social contact. And I don't think New York is unusual among big cities in this way, but you actually are pretty intimate with a lot of strangers throughout the course of your everyday life, whether you're like crammed in someone's armpit on the subway or, you know, like in a throng of people on the sidewalk, or you go to a restaurant and you're like literally rubbing elbows with people. So like, I do think there was already a degree of comfort with intimacy built into the level of contact and sort of propinquity in a city like that. So to some degree, I could just show up in some of the spaces where that contact was already happening, make introductions, and sort of allow people to become familiar with me. And I spent enough time doing that that I think people just kind of got used to my being around and got more comfortable with me. And I'm certain, too, that my own identity played a role in that. So, you know, I think being a white middle class, sort of almost naively friendly, hetero cis, but not like too hetero cis man, you know, probably helped me out in that way. And eventually I was able to sort of get to know a lot of different kinds of people. But I also say, like, in terms of the everyday life part, it really varied by participant. So there were people like Wadi who, you know, pretty much right away was ready to spend a lot of time with me over a long period of time. And he had no concerns about letting me tag along for pretty much anything he might be doing. And he'd call and say, "Hey, I'm going to the doctor. I'm going to get some computer lessons at the Apple store. You know, might that be of interest to you?" And there we would go. And he eventually started to think the book was about him, and introduced me as his biographer, which, you know, in some ways he turned out to be right. It would have been a much different book without him. But so there were a few people who were like, "Yeah, my life is interesting. Let's do this. You know, I can totally see why you would want to spend time with me." But you know, then there were other people who were a lot more reluctant, either because they were busy or because they were rightly reasonably suspicious of this stranger who was coming and asking questions. I had one participant named Carmen who would only let me come and talk to her in a space that she was familiar with when there were other people who were her friends around. There were other people who I could only sort of contact or spend time with, in pretty constrained settings. So like a lot of things around work where it was harder to get a sense for what their everyday lives were like. And there were some people who I spent a lot of time with for a short amount of time, and then they moved away and, I didn't have much contact with them after that. So, I would say a lot of these were person by person negotiations. And I, in some cases I really felt like I was pestering people, to try and maintain that. And in other cases, I almost had the opposite problem where I ended up, feeling like I was sort of a person for people to spend time with and talk to, you know. What am I going to do today? I wonder if Christian's around to hang out. Give him a call. We'll go shopping.
Yeah, that's great though that, you know, you made people comfortable with doing that. So that's very helpful to hear. And, you know, you mentioned worry quite a bit, but I wanted to talk a little bit about Bob, who's, I don't know, in my view, like a very interesting collaborator that you had. And early in the book, you share how he really compelled you to focus on the big picture, in his words, something that he felt like he couldn't get to do in his day-to-day as an urban activist. And this instance really struck with me because I think he's really urging not just you, but a lot of us as researchers to articulate our roles in continuous dialogue with community members we work with. So I'm wondering how his provocations on, you know, how you should go about this research impacted your approach, and how did you position yourself within their activism and everyday practices, especially, you know, as someone invited to think about the big picture?
Yeah, this is another great question. And, you know, that instance and Bob's provocation obviously really stuck with me too, which is why it shows up right at the beginning in the framing of the book in the way that it does. And so, you know, just to say a little bit more about Bob, he was a tenant organizer, a housing organizer at this organization called Housing Conservation Coordinators, an organization that Wadi was actually on the board of directors for. But he spent a lot of time, you know, doing, I think he started in the 70s. So he had decades of experience, you know, doing tenant organizing at a very fine grained scale. So he knew that neighborhood block by block. He knew stories about what happened in those buildings. And, you know, 20 years ago, there was a person who was the head of the co-op board here and they ousted him and we turned it into limited equity co-op, you know, almost like at a unit by unit level. He knew that neighborhood, and he had worked to try and organize against displacement and to set up sort of durable structures for different kinds of tenant rights and different kinds of housing options. So, you know, he provoked me by saying, essentially, tell me something that I don't know from an angle that I haven't thought about. And he was very clear that he had spent time, you know, he considered himself, what did he say? I consider myself a communist, but I've ended up on these panels with academic Marxists who's, you know, only have one story. Okay, I know that story, and it is the story of how powerful capitalism is and you know, how gentrification is a freight train that's going to crush everything in its way. That's not very helpful for me as an organizer, nor is the story about how gentrification is, you know, the sort of liberal story about how gentrification is a force of nature, you know, like a market set of improvements that are going to lift all boats. Tell me a story that's not either of those two stories, and that might actually be helpful in my organizing. And tell me a story that has a perspective that I couldn't get in my own day-to-day blur. So that was a kind of a gut check moment for me, because I think at that point in the research, I was drawing a lot conceptually on a lot of urban theories that sort of repeated one or another of those framings and tended to think about urbanism at scales and in terms of processes that really sort of dwarfed and squished the kind of level that Bob was operating on. And honestly, like having a lot of success and impact at that level. So that really pushed me to think about a lot of the questions that I ended up thinking about and frame things the way that I did. At the same time, you know, I appreciate your question about the component of this that's about activism too, because I don't think that a lot of the participants would have self-identified as an activist necessarily. So like Wadi maybe, but, you know, he tended to think of himself as like a citizen, and a lot of the people tended to think of themselves as kind of people who were acting and going with the flow of being good citizens rather than people who were shaping the flow, if that makes sense. So I think, you know, people tended to imagine themselves a lot in terms of the kind of Jane Jacobs language around citizenship or eyes on the street. And so part of the unsettling impulse for the book also came from kind of trying to talk to people about the way that their activities fit into these bigger forces that were going on in the neighborhood, and realizing that they themselves had these kind of naturalized stories about how powerful all these forces were and didn't necessarily see their own actions as lining up with those things. So there, you know, and that was a tricky thing to navigate. I shared a copy of the manuscript with a colleague at one point. And he was somebody who's in like a classics department who thinks a lot about the structure of like different Greek story types. And he was like, you know, at some moments it seems like you are like the diligent reporter and you are trying to just do, you know, maintain fidelity to the story of telling the facts. But then at other points, it's like you are the person who's like commenting and intervening and trying to gently pull like a Socratic method kind of thing with these people. So which is it? And I was like, yeah, it's a good point. I don't know that I ever managed to totally strike that balance or land on either one of those sides. So I'd say at a minimum, I tried not to let them like instrumentalize what I was doing, because there were moments where they were like, something happened out on the street last night, and I'm pretty sure you have notes that, you know, tell us who started the fight in the parking lot of the nightclub or whatever. And I had to be like, I'm putting my hands up for your listeners. They can't see that. I had to be like, yeah, no, I don't have information on that. I can't intervene in that particular debate or like identify people to sic the police on.
Well, sounds very much like ethnography without guarantees.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you have had those experiences as well.
Definitely. Haven't we all? Before we wrap up, Christian, I'd like to ask you, what is next for you? What are some new projects, questions, or even classes, teaching are you working on currently?
Yeah, I like it. That's always the almost a scarier question too, right? Because for this project now, I know a little bit how to talk about it. For the future, it's always like, oh yeah, what am I doing right now in this blur of everyday life? So I moved away from New York in 2012, and now I live in Seattle, which is its own interesting kind of place. with a lot of different kind of stuff going on. So I think I'm just like sort of following my way, which is to land in a place and be like, wait, what the heck is going on here? So a lot of the stuff I'm working on now is sort of place-based research related to what's happening in Seattle, particularly around kind of, some people here call it Amazonification, which is like a particular kind of like, you know, Amazon has its headquarters here, and it has redeveloped entire neighborhoods to be its sort of urban campus headquarters. And that's had ripple effects through the whole region in terms of housing and transit and infrastructure and really the culture and the sort of dominant forms of common sense about the identity of the city, the history and the future of the city. So I've been doing a lot of work with sort of people who are community-based, who are place-based activists, artists, storytellers, thinking about doing stuff like oral history, archival work, public curation, that sort of pushes back on some of the dominant narratives, tries to preserve some of the history, and sort of curate different ways of thinking about the sort of diverse histories of the place that don't show up in some of these dominant narratives. So one project that I'm working on is this sort of convening called the People's Geography of Seattle that tries to bring together different people to think about that. And there's another project that's kind of a sub aspect of that that's called the Seattle Black History, Black Spatial Histories Institute. And that's being spearheaded by this really awesome organization called Wanawari that's located in the sort of historically Black central district of Seattle. And they're doing a lot of really awesome place-based oral histories, just sort of training community researchers to go out and do community-based story gathering to sort of reframe the popular understandings and really make claims on the value of different historical experiences in spaces that are now being gentrified. So kind of pushing back on dominant discourses and perceptions of Black and other BIPOC people and spaces in the city. So that's a big part of it. And then, you know, in the back of my mind, there's a lot of stuff around climate right now as well. So I'd say like the long-term future project is going to probably try to apply some of these lenses we've been talking about to thinking about everyday forms of engagement with or participation in different climate futures in urban space. But we'll see what that looks like. That's just coming off a summer of heat waves and wildfire smoke thinking.
Very fair.
Yeah, that's probably the future.
Yeah, well, these all sound really fascinating, and we'll be looking forward to these works. So thank you very much, Christian, for joining us and for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me. And also thanks to your listeners. I feel like if you made it all the way to the end here, I appreciate your patience. And anybody get in touch if you heard anything you want to talk more about.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's been my pleasure, and I'm sure it's been a pleasure for our listeners as well.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much.
I'm your host, Aliza Rujan. This discussion of urbanism without guarantees, the everyday life of a gentrifying West Side neighborhood, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2020, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.